In October 1935, Neil Lyndon Sandry, aged 18, set sail on the old Barrabool, a one-class steamship, accompanied by his mother, bound for England. It had been Neil's ambition for many years. We go back to earlier days, the days that led up to that departure.
Chapter 1. The Twig is Bent. My first boat was made by myself from a sheet of galvanised iron, with the ends bent double and sealed, a wooden seat crossing the centre and holding the sides apart. The paddle was crude, as the rest of it. I was about 6 at the time. We lived on the front of a quiet seaside resort, facing the Gulf, about 7 miles from Adelaide, the capital of South Australia. Without being able to word it then, I had an uttermost sense of freedom when paddling that canoe. An adult's weight would have sunk it at first contact. Balancing it while getting in and riding the shallows or rougher waves was a feat in itself. In rougher weather, I sometimes gave my household acute anxiety when I went far out into the sun's dazzle after some real or imaginary object floating on the sea. Once I bumped inshore an old oil drum thrown overboard from a passing vessel, and had more joy working the thing to land than the worth of it, although it became a fine backyard furnace in time. Then there was another vessel, made from oddments and part of a half-rotted dinghy found embedded in the sand far along the shore. I cannot remember enjoying any toys in infancy unless they bore sails, and as soon as I knew what tools were, I was making models and shaping objects I invested with grace and power, which they did not possess. Ships, in one way and another, came to represent the most beautiful things in life, provided they had sails. One wintry day, when I was a lanky schoolboy, we looked from the windows of an old beach house and saw the morning dense with fog, and though this was unusual enough to cause interest, that was not the reason for the excitement almost sending me crazy. Incredibly, in the whirling greyness clouding the foreshore and blotting out all distances, a great three-masted bark lay like a ghost. I was out of the house, across the road, down the slopes of the beach in a series of unthinking leaps, and landed, panting, in a small group of boys and adults, attracted from their homes to look more closely at the ship, now motionless, close to the shore. It was the Garfnil, whose navigators had become confused in the fog about them and driven ashore some miles south of her proper anchorage. To me, she was perfect, outlined softly yet clearly in the grey indistinctiveness, with her rigging a mere suggestion over the smudged hull. A thing more of imagination than reality, she nevertheless was real enough for me to hear the swish of a bucket of slops thrown overboard. Voices sounded aboard her, echoing out the calm water. Gulls mowed above her, surprised as we were. I almost howled in the spell of that hour, without being able to explain the sensation that made everything else unimportant. And now I know it was then, facing the ghostly bark in the fog, that I knew what I wanted from life. Summed up in a word, it was ships. I was very impressionable, enthusiastic, impatient, and all the faulty things young boys are. For weeks I was misery to all about me with my incessant talks of ships, travel and the like. The fantastical nature of some of those prophecies can be imagined when one day I assured my mother, in all good faith, that pirate days were not over, and I was sure I had a bit of a pirate in me. The ship's interlude, despite former crazes to make them, own them, use them, and read about them, was accredited to the visit of the Garfnil. But I became so tiresome that at last an uncle, in sheer desperation, gave me some crisp advice that killed a few of my dreams, but performed good work in forming a practical outlook. In planning and building my first useful ship, I found the greatest joy in living. The other members of the household then had some peace. Only a road, some slopping sand, and the beach lay between our home of that of the time and the sea. The shore to the north stretched towards Port Adelaide, to the south, to the rocks and the cliffs beyond Brighton. In a large brick lobby and on the southern side veranda of an old house facing the Gulf Water, I established my shipbuilding operations. The young boy's needs creative effort. Find out his natural vocational interest when in knickerbockers, give him a box of tools, and it is fairly safe to bet on his escaping futility or crime when older. And make him earn money to help buy the tools and material he works with. Things too easily come by have not much real value. School was an evil necessity, interrupting my other tasks. As soon as I escaped lessons, I tore home on my bicycle to get busy again, and all my restlessness changed to a deep content and satisfaction. The design I finally worked out now seems crude, but it was actually the beginning of a canoe that sailed. Glaring mistakes showed up when half constructed, alterations then in the frames, and a hard lesson in patience and concentration. The canvassing was done when I should have been studying for examinations. For these I sat with my brain full of sails. Perhaps it prevented the over-anxiety so often numbing students' wits at examinations. Much to the amazement of the family, I passed with high marks. They were not more amazed than I was. Making a boat led to endless avenues of thought and discovery. It was like opening a door to an unguessed-at new world. Every book and magazine I could get hold of, I devoured. Travel, navigation, ocean voyaging, shipbuilding, small boat construction, and the romance and history and legends of the sea filled every hour with happiness beyond description. In a pile of overseas journals, I came across a series of articles by William Albert Robinson, giving an account of his voyage round the world in his little ketch, Zwap. This presented a new aspect of sailing. Previously, other crazes had afflicted me and made misery for the household. This craze, however, refused to die of its own fever. I discovered one side of my family to have descended through a line of Cornish people with a strong taste for romance, poetry, folklore, literature, and, of course, the sea and the ships upon it. This assured me of many things, and a craze developed. Relations said I was being ruined by dreaming about sailing and voyaging. What sort of career was that? They sat like a jury to decide my fate. But I had an understanding friend in my mother, who listened, refused to quarrel, and let her Celtic imagination run free with mine. "Go into an office like anyone else," I heard from one. "Banking clerks lead somewhere." "Where?" "Go in for accountancy, study agriculture." And a final snub from a great aunt. "Wandering around in a dirty little boat isn't very gentlemanly, is it?" I took this as an insult to every ocean voyager and smouldered in a black mood for days. At last I heard in words, "A round peg in a square hole isn't much use to the world or anyone in it, not even yourself. Dreaming alone won't take you anywhere. Life is pretty hard taking it all round, so make it easier by working for what you want, earning all you get, and expecting nothing for nothing. If you've sails in your head instead of figures, then study sails and ships. Of course, if you could write later," write? That was an idea. "Then my office would be under my hat." But it took me hours of concentration to form one letter, and my handwriting was appalling. The idea, however, sank in. It sank in so far but a long time elapsed before it emerged again. Every Saturday I vanished on my bicycle to pedal along the roads bordering the swamps and dunes in the direction of Port Adelaide, where a foremast of masts and funnels made magic of the dirty wharfs and creek-furrowed shores. The mosquito fleet was there, catches under 100 tons which ply between the small Gulf ports with the yearly output of wheat and barley. From the seamen in those vessels I gathered a wealth of interesting fact and fancy, but I assume now that I must have pestered them to fury. All the family members were sea-minded, even to my grandmother, a gentle and lovely woman of over 70 then. I lived for some years in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, going back to South Australia on school vacations, so at 9 I was accustomed to travelling alone interstate by steamer and finding my way about. This kept me from apron strings, though there wasn't any danger of that at home. Before I wore my first long pants, I had lived or stayed in every capital city in Australia and knew all the steamers and their routes and histories. But I longed to grow up and really scorn ships that did not possess sails. The day of sail was done, said some people, who tried to discourage me. This I argued down, until I began to be avoided when that look came into my eye. I wanted desperately to achieve a manly freedom and escape the discipline of school. Now at the ripe old age of 21, I can smile at that, for freedom lessened and discipline actually commenced when I left school. I happened to obtain a Duck's certificate and thought my education had ended with a neat full stop, but only the introduction to education had finished. I left school rather suddenly, as while going on with the following term, I obeyed an impulse and applied by letter for a job on an Adelaide newspaper. One morning, leaving for school as usual, I chanced to look into the letterbox, a thing I seldom did, and within 3 minutes was racing through the house, shouting at my news as I hastily changed from school togs and into a city suit. Trains to the city ran at intervals. One was almost due. I had to call on the newspaper editor to whom I had written. Later on in the morning, I telephoned my home from town and with pride that almost burst me, said I was an employee of the press. That night I returned home, feeling rather sheepish for having taken steps immediately. I was told that having undertaken the job, I had to stick to it. Sobered a little, I thought it out, and responsibility came. After acquitting myself with sufficient decency to keep from being fired, I realised the monotony of the job. I was kept running all over the city for or with copy, and had 1,000 small tasks to perform for editors and lesser gentry of the press. School had enabled me to spend a few daylight hours on or in the sea. Freedom had gone. So had my Saturday mornings on the bicycle round.
Peter Burden is reading from Neil Lyndon Sandry's Boyhood Memoirs. Neil went on to serve on many ships during World War II. He became a very skillful sailor and often skippered the ships he sailed on.
Without entering unnecessarily into family affairs, bereavement and upheaval caused us to move to Melbourne. References and introductions gained my admission to Melbourne newspaper, where I was soon transferred from the boys' status to the pictorial library. Handling thousands of photographs from overseas services was in itself an education, but whetted my appetite for wandering. The idea of running away to sea sometimes haunted me, but somehow my home life checked that. and the quitting habit soon gets you when you start bolting from things you don't like. Inevitably, I was spending most of my free time on the water and studying all I could of ships, navigation, and the wider places of the world. After a few months at work, I was given night duty at the office, which left my days free for sailing. We lived then, of course, facing the sea at St. Kilda, quite near several yacht and dinghy clubs. The atmosphere of any large newspaper office is infectious. I absorbed a certain amount of jargon and information regarding the needs of the press. Without disclosing my age, I wrote to the editor of a yachting journal in another city and collared an order to supply from Victoria a monthly column of notes and news. A violent storm smashed up the seafront and damaged sheds and boats. I wrote this up with photographs I took, and the article was printed with illustrations. This was a definite encouragement. I recall being highly tickled by the address on my letters from this journal's editor. Sea fever is well named. The kind of restlessness I knew could be quietened only by some job of creative work. My first tin canoe had long ago departed into the limbo of dead ships. Others, made during school holidays, had been sold at a reasonable profit. I had a little money in hand, was earning wages, and paid my contribution weekly into the household, and bought many of my own clothes. I was not asked for board money, but know now why it was not refused. Let a chap lean on indulgence when young, and watch him go on leaning. Getting things for nothing starts the habit, and he goes on wanting things for nothing all of his life. Having to work from about 4 each afternoon until midnight, was able to get into good sleep and rise early enough to feel the day as I liked. Building was the idea. This time I set to work on sailing dinghy, completely decked in with watertight cockpit to the design of the now popularly known in Australia, VJ, or Vaucluse Junior. I believe this one was the first to be built and sailed in Victoria. When completed, it enabled me to go out into Port Phillip Bay single-handed when desired. The boat, when capsized, could be righted with a little ingenuity and weight. A friend went out with me on one occasion without realizing this convenience, and when we upset, he resigned himself to climbing on the side for a slow drift inshore, but was astonished when thrown into the sea again as I righted the boat. For youngsters learning to sail, if they can swim a bit, this craft is ideal, though they grow careless about capsizing. Port Phillip is frequently cursed by the sailing fraternity for its boisterous and unpredictable conditions and rough, steep seas. This, however, creates excellent seamen in time, and they are trained to meet nearly every sailing emergency. Sydney Harbour, on the other hand, is ideal for sailing alone, but does little to foster the true seamanship which, logically, ought to be the aim of the yachtsman. Chapter 2. Across the World. Saving money in odd amounts, I plodded alone in captivity, but relief was at hand, although not quite the kind of escape I wanted. One night at home, I was told we were leaving shortly for England. Immediately, I had the idea of working my way on some rascally small tramp steamer as, again, in adventurous fiction. But while the notion was not ridiculed, it soon proved to be impractical. In fact, there had been another bereavement in the family, and for several unhappy reasons, my mother would have to make the journey alone if I went by an unconventional boat. Also, I saw the advantages of acquiring some useful educational knowledge en route. She and I are, and were, excellent friends. I went on working, disposing of the boat, attending to my affairs, and sailing while she attended to the 100 domestic, commercial, and other details connected with home, income tax, passports, rates of exchange, steamer bookings, and finance. This was no trouble to my mother, as she frequently gone without fuss to other places, including the far western regions of Papua, and on a long camel trek for thousands of miles through central Australia. So a simple voyage to England presented few problems, apart from the financial strain. All my life, I have feared the failure of any plan discussed too much beforehand, so said nothing at the office about going away. After a while, however, I told the staff supervisor in confidence. Some kind of perversity bade me ask him, also for a raise in salary, and to my amazement, it was given. It would help with the trip, I was told. As the shipping offices gave no hope of a passage for some months, I settled down again and started saving a little more. It happened that a chance came to get the passages at once, as my mother had been in close touch with the shipping people, and although this was a rush, we took the opportunity rather than wait so long. Early in October of 1935, we sailed on the Old Barrabool, a one-class steamer which had excellent accommodation and more freedom on board than most liners. A merciful 21st birthday gift, a comfortable sum of money sent to me from a sheep station out back, was just what I needed to cover the costs of the journey independently. The donor impressed upon me that the gift was being 3 years too soon for my 21st birthday. I need expect no gift at all when coming of age. Not until the pilot boat heaved its way from beside the steamer late one night, out from Port Phillip, could I get into my head that we were on the way. So we cleared the rip for the open sea and ploughed round the coast for Adelaide. Calling in there was a queer experience. We were visitors, sliding on the first leg of a long voyage and on past shores where I had built my tin canoe. Young as I was, I felt old as the boat moved steadily along the track where we had so often seen from the old beach house other steamers travelling. A sense of disassociation quietened my mother also. The pale dunes baked in the hot sunlight were too reminiscent of those whom she had loved, now dead and gone. The old Garfniel still seemed, to me, to lie in the fog obscuring the beach one wintry day. But we were merely passing by, callers in, and the Barrabool nosed her way onwards to the heat of the outer harbour, which is surely one of the most desolate introductions to any civilised country.
Peter Burden is reading from Neil Lyndon Sandry's Boyhood Memoirs.
The Great Australian Bight is often compared to the Bay of Biscay. Impressions depend upon circumstance. When I was two, we crossed the bight in weather that crashed a deck piano from one end of the space to the other until it skidded, ended in being anchored by sailors with ropes. On this crossing, in the Barrabool, we forged for days through weather, in a heavy smooth swell, with the sea blue as the pictures on travel folders. There was nothing unusual to record. Passengers segregated themselves in congenial groups. Prim folk criticised the gay defied the wagging tongues of the gossips. Several assigned love affairs came to a head, and several scandals burned themselves to death. Several minor social wars were concluded triumphantly. The inevitable old maid gossip in pants paraded the decks with other old maids, in skirts hanging delightedly about him, and the inevitable man, with a cap tied down round his ears, read alone in the smoke lounge and did his smile each night after dinner. Girls squealed over deck games and everyone aired their tropical clothing. A group of sophisticates took charge of a portion of the boat deck and there congregated in superior fashion for gramophone music and morning champagne with stout, and the stewards went on looking as if they saw and heard nothing while seeing and hearing everything. The weather changed from hot to very hot, and from very hot to tropical, and 10 days of steady progress led our prow towards Ceylon. The coastline crept towards us one morning, just in time to save most of us from boredom. The low, unchanging shoreline was still distant, but presently high peaks thrust upwards through the mist and vapours swirling from hidden valleys. Sailing catamarans took shape from small dark squares moving on the blue. The breeze from land is characteristically Ceylon, a mixed scent suggesting flowers, coconut oil, leaf mould and soil. Adam's Peak decided to tower free of its usual wrapping of cloud. Colombo was not far ahead. We had made up a small group of 4 or 5 intimates on board. My mother, a young woman friend, Major Long, who is well known at sea, and the only other young passenger, an Englishman, leaving 5 years of sheep farming in New Zealand. Major Long was delightedly like the retired army colonels one sees in Punct, and a great acquisition to the party. Brian could not be more conventionally English. An old Carthusian with a school-tie atmosphere about all he said and did. He was a grand fellow to know. The Major had been telling us how to make hammocks for sleeping out on board in more tropical parts, and Brian and I determined to buy the material in Colombo and make some. We arrived at the wharf in grand style, as the Major invited us with him on a private launch sent out by a friend. Changing Australian currency into rupees and cents took little time at the bureau on a steamy wharf. Topees and white clothing had seemed rather theatrical on board, leaving, but the thick warmth of the town struck us. We felt theatrical no more. Native traffic cops and friendly souls, but the haphazard way of rickshaws, bullock carts, bicycles, smart European cars and pedestrians of many shades and temperaments soon explained why. Colombo was more like a mob scene on a stage than a town. We made for the GOH to drink long pilsners before tackling the traffic and the unfamiliar shops and streets. Brian and myself deserted the others to be trotted off in rickshaws on our search for cord and teak for hammocks. The sizeable stores could not oblige, so we were taken off towards the native quarters, where countless tired-looking shops clustered lovingly in apparently never-ending rows. The din in these areas was brain-splitting. By and by we realised the futility of moving by rickshaw, so dismissed the boys and pressed forward on foot. The favourite sport of a Ceylon native seems to be sleeping. The art of this is not in losing consciousness, but in the suddenness with which it is done. I saw one old fellow, about 6'4" long, blissfully slumbering while folded up like a pocket knife in a child's toy cart. Brian, very characteristically, commenced to feel aloof from the congestion of noise, smells, and shining dark bodies, and with terse but courteous explanations, wanted the cool GOH lounge again. But that cord had to be found, and so we blundered on. We escaped one dubious shop by purchasing native sandals and a doubtful cobra skin belt. Swarms of anxious mendicants and merchants overwhelmed us. The heat was incredible. Oceans of brown faces and bodies swept upon us with bunches of bananas, silks, shirts, belts, and sickly fruits and cakes that would turn a goat's stomach. I lost Brian to haul him a little later from the clutches of a whirlpooling crowd of natives he was trying to discourage uselessly with his beautiful politeness. Pushing a bunch of bananas from beneath his disgusted nose, he clutched me, and together we dived into an open doorway. The place was a rope bazaar. We found our rope, but the usual comic warfare had to be gone through while the price came down to half the original amount, and so we wended our way, literally, towards a timber yard for teak to provide the spreaders for the hammocks. A boy listened with sweat, wearing a breech clout and a wide-tooth grin, cut the timber with an ugly-looking saw. A few days later, on board the Barrable, in the hotter tropics, I was clad almost similarly while sawing and planing the timber on the boat deck. She was a friendly steamer, and in some odd way, our party had claimed most of one part of the boat deck so decidedly that it became ours for the voyage. However, we left the timber yard by rickshaw, and an extra zealous salesman followed me so persistently while shouting about the beautiful shirt he waved like a flag that I bought it. Over a mile of perspiration and trotting after me, the price came down from 5 shillings to 1. Whether his urge to make a sale overcame his avarice or not, I do not know. The shirt was a particularly good one. We wondered why, with so many costly and modern cars about in the other part of town, they all possessed the ancient rubber bulb horn. We then discovered that the electric siren would quickly exhaust any battery, as in crowded areas abounded with brown bodies that make no effort to move out of the way. Shifting them is a problem. We watched one driver hoot until the air vibrated with the warning, then go into reverse, work backwards through swarms of dark folk, and finally reverse in another direction to let a lumbering bullock cart pass. Naturally, there are beautiful roads and streets where the European car sweeps along, unhampered. Tourist sights and adventures did not lure either of us, so before going on board the steamer, I hired a dinghy and a boy to row Brian and myself out to a Maldivian bagala. This was not done, he informed me, by way of duty. However, we did it. She was a large vessel of about 80 tons, with two short, thick masts, having a decided forward rake.
Peter Burden was reading from Neil Lyndon Sandry's boyhood memoirs. Neil and his mother reached England aboard the Barrable. During World War II, Neil served in the US Army small ships, and he was skipper of the Timoshenko, carrying US troops for the advanced landing at Pongai, Papua New Guinea, in October 1942. The Timoshenko and another small ship, King John, were mistaken for Japanese vessels and attacked by an American bomber. 2 men were killed and 18 wounded in the attack. It was a perilous existence for those small ships, such as the ones that Neil served on.